Good evening, everybody. I can only apologise for the temperature and the lack of oxygen in this room, but that won't dim our enthusiasm, certainly won't dim my enthusiasm, to hear Sonia Correa speaking this evening about her work in Latin America on this really important topic. And I was just discussing with Sonia last week. I was at the decennial conference on abortion in Africa, and that's why I just thought, let's just start with this map of the world, which in a very crude traffic light way tells us a little bit about the state of the world's abortion laws. And one of the themes that came out of the African regional conference was very much that progress towards the liberalisation and the decriminalisation of abortion is actually happening at a much faster rate at the moment in sub-Saharan Africa compared to the forces at work in Latin America and the Caribbean. So I just thought we'd start with that visual. I'm absolutely delighted to be able to introduce Sonia Correa, who is a giant in this field, metaphorically, academically, and intellectually. And I'm really looking forward to hearing you talking about the exceptionalism. Mm. And I look forward to the day when we're no longer talking about exceptionalism, we're talking about the normalism of these issues. So, let me get your PowerPoint and over to you. Okay. Sonia, thank you so much. There's some water there, if you'd like it.
So, everybody. Something happened here, no video input.
See, there's a... Is it okay? Oh, it's gone to the screen.
Yeah. I don't know why.
Oh, it was just working absolutely fine. Let's hit the escape button. Because it's on something... Sorry, Sonia is now faced with a completely blank screen.
So, but I can just... I can perhaps look that side and try to
let me work backwards and try and get the slideshow back up. Yeah. I'm really sorry, I don't know what's happening.
Okay, I can just look. You just have to pay attention that I'll be looking on both sides. Well, first of all, came back. So it's a great pleasure to be here today. I have to thank first of all, the Leverhulme Trust for this opportunity of this professorship at the London School of Economics that has been incredibly instigating and productive for me. It's always good to get off the mud of the world and be able to think and read outside of the confusion and the blurred conditions of activism. And also to the Gender Institute, and in particular to the Department of Social Policy, to Anastina and Hakam for giving me the opportunity to share these ideas today. Yeah. What I'm going to bring to you is a very brief panorama, very short panorama of abortion politics in Latin America, with a more detailed focus on the trajectory of the 2012 Uruguayan reform, abortion reform. The analysis I'll be presenting on Uruguay is the result of a case study that we have performed, me, the Argentinian political scientist Mario Piceni, in partnership with MISO, which is Mujer en Salud en Uruguay, one of the major abortion rights organizations in Latin America, that was funded, supported by the International Women's Health Coalition. And the report, which is the cover, Abortos Interruptus, was the Spanish version, the big report, was launched in October in Montevideo in ECLAC, the Economic Regional Commission meeting on the biannual women's conference of Latin America. And very soon, a short version of the report is going to be published by Reproductive Health Matters. I expect to have it out in January or February, so everybody's going to be able to read it. No? The structure of my talk will be this broad view on Latin America, looking a little bit into la longue durée, current politics, talking about regressions in the few gains, some key social demographic features, and then Uruguayan exceptionality, concentrating on, I'm calling the abortion law reform saga, because it has been really a saga, no? And lessons learned. Well, to do a few review of the long cycle in current politics in Latin America, we would need to look into many layers and aspects, like legal history, current legal dimensions, epistemological aspects, modalities of statecraft, the different actors in the landscape, micropolitics of gender. I don't have time to talk about that, but let's keep that in mind, that what I'm giving is a very superficial bird's eye view, but we have to keep that in mind, no? But I thought it was necessary to talk about that, to locate the Uruguayan case in that larger context. Huh? Since the 1980s, political struggles around legal abortion is a main feature of American, Latin America, sexual and reproductive and gender politics, as part of the overarching process of democratization and deepening of democracy. You have to always situate those debates in that context. Uruguay is exemplary in that regard, but in practically all countries after 1970, late 1970, feminist organizations, feminist movements, the first voices to claim for abortion rights. And this has evolved in times, sometimes just feminists by themselves, but evolving towards alliances with medical sectors, public health professionals, lawyers, media people, and being resisted and reacted to by many different factors, but most principally the politics of religious dogmatism, and in particular the Catholic Church. These conditions have created a dominant perception that one, abortion, legal abortion is a novelty in Latin America, something that had begun just the other day. And the second is that all the barriers to right to abortion come from the Catholic Church and its doctrines. And I think this is partially true, but this perception conceals two important aspects that I want to underline here. The first is that, yes, colonial laws in Latin America derived from canonical law, this means Catholic doctrine, punished a wide range of sexual deviants. The list of sexual deviances in the Philippine ordinances in Brazil, you can just laugh, it's enormous, but they did not punish the abortion. And this is so because colonial laws and canonic law was grounded on the Aquinas doctrine of the gradual ensoulment of the embryo. This is very important because, and this is post-colonial analysis, the very first laws to criminalize abortion in Latin America are very modern and very secular. They are derivations of the Napoleonic Code of 1810, that is the basic inspiration of all post-independence criminal codes in the region, with variations. Some of them use a Spanish code that is also derived from the Napoleon Code, but the source is basically the Napoleon Code, that it's based on Roman law, back there. The other thing is that, well, an important aspect is that these early codes, the early 19th century, they did not criminalize women. They criminalized the agents of abortion, but never women. However, later reforms in the late 19th century and early 20th century, mainly inspired by European criminology, and here I'm talking Lombroso, all the criminal anthropology, criminal science of the late, very gender and racially biased. It was then that women were to be criminalized for the first time. The second thing is that abortion has been decriminalized in few places in Latin America long before we began our struggles. The first case is Yucatan in Mexico in 1926 under the Calles administration. This is right after the Mexican Revolution. This is the period of radical laicite in Mexico. They were chasing the church, the priests. And this law derives from a visit of Margaret Sanger to Mexico in the 20s, which is very interesting. There's a whole story there. The second is Uruguay. Uruguay had a brief moment of legal abortion between 34 and 38. And the third is Cuba, 1961, right after the revolution. And the genealogy of this reform is the Soviet Union, is Emma Goldman back in the Soviet Union in the 1917s. Most prohibition laws that are still in the books today derive from 1930s, 1940s reforms that were done in a moment that is called the modernization of the region in many countries. And it was then that the Catholic Church began to systematically engage with abortion issues, not before that. And it was able to influence some reforms, just like in the case of Peru, there was already a strong influence of the Catholic Church. But this church presence in the debate intensified after 1970, because this was when the Vatican established a clear, systematic counterinsurgency strategy, a global one, to prevent that the reforms in the US and Europe would spread across the world. It was a deliberate Vatican strategy. So when we began claiming for abortion rights in the 80s, this counterinsurgency was already in place. We were already coping with these forces. They included, in fact, preemptive measures, as in the case of Chile. In Chile, Pinochet, during the dictatorship, had made a constitutional reform that included the right from conception in 1980, very early in time. We're going to see the information later on. And then in 88, he deleted from the Penal Code the only exception that was therapeutic abortion. Democratic transition began. La Concertación, which is the political coalition that led the transition and is still in power, Michelle Bachelet. La Concertación sat with the Catholic Church and made an agreement, a cavalier agreement, that abortion would not be touched. And we had to wait until this year, 2016, for the first provision to be tabled. Later on, because the Catholic Church continues its influence, let me just say something. In the case of Brazil in particular, the Vatican pressure did not work. We had a constitutional reform in 86-88, strong pressure of the Vatican, and we managed not to let right to life from conception to be enshrined in the Constitution. But now it's under threat right now. In other places, the influence of the Catholic Church over politicians, political parties, the juridical apparatus made that three other countries have deleted abortion from the Penal Code. Honduras in 91, El Salvador in 98, and Nicaragua. The case of Nicaragua deserves the whole story in itself because that agreement was part of the negotiation between Ortega and the Catholic Church to get reelected when he could not. So it's a very dirty story that needs to be told. Not just that, but in parallel, huge efforts to include the right to life from conception in legislation. So you see all the countries that between Chile in 1980 and after 2007, Ernestina, that works in Mexico, knows, after the AF reform, Mexico has state-level penal codes. It's like the US. So after the DF reform, there was a whole pressure, and there are 17 states in Mexico that have the right to life from conception, including Yucatan. The very earliest reform in Latin America was struck down by this movement. And as you can see, Latin America is the region of the world where we have had more regressive policies, even than other regions. There's an advancement in Africa also. There's lots of Kenya, Guinea Equatorial, there's also Poland. Hungary, no? But the American, Latin American situation is worst. For sure, the Catholic Church is a main actor, but we have to count with other important forces, evangelical churches, and also secular conservative voices that play a role in these regressions. In this gloomy scenario, we have the good news. Three reforms that have granted or expanded the right to abortion. Colombia is a Supreme Court decision of 2006 that enlarged access to abortion. It's not full legalization, but gave access to abortion in the case of physical and mental health, which is very broad. And then Mexico DF in 2007 and the Uruguay reform that I'm going to talk about. Chile and El Salvador now have provisions being discussed by the parliaments. They are very limited. It's rape, women's lives, fetal abnormalities. But considering that this abortion is pure homicide in those countries, this is to be considered good, despite limited. Well, the case study methodology, I'm moving to Uruguay. We had done literature review in Spanish. There's lots of cases, stories written about the Uruguayan reform. And we have spoken with 27 individuals and made groups interviews, and we have validated these interviews. The case, this was done in 2015. A little bit about Latin America, just to remind us, that this is not just the abortion story. It's a very unequal region. We have 40% of people living under poverty, roughly. 12% under extreme poverty. Income distribution is really one of the worst in the world. The 10 richer percent get 14 times what the 40% at the bottom of the pyramid get each year. But we have gone through demographic transition since the 50s. The number of children per woman went down from 6 to replacement level in 2015, roughly. And there's a very interesting data, which is that we have more women than men in the region. Women exceed men by 9 million, which is an effect of structural violence. Men are dying because of the effect of the drug, the war against drugs and drug itself. So it's a structural violence. And abortion has played a major role in this fertility decline in the past and even today. Because as Alan Gutmacher estimates, abortion rates have in fact increased in Latin America from the 90s to now. So we had 27 to 33 in Central America and 47. It's not a slight increase, but it's very significant, which means that policies are not working. Access to contraception is not there. There's a problem of social policy that this indicator suggests. As for Uruguay, in this context, Uruguay is a very tiny country, 3 million people. Half of the people living in the capital, Montevideo. Levels of education have been historically higher than the regional average. Uruguay has always had lower levels of inequality. It's a much more homogeneous society. There are Afro-Uruguayans, but it's not the same percentage of the population as in Brazil or Colombia. There's a rather solid public health system historically that has been strengthened after the left gained power 12 years ago. A very stable political system. Composed basically by three parties, the old parties of the 19th century, the Colorados and the Blancos, the conservative and the liberals of the 19th century, and the Frente Amplio, which is the left-wing coalition. It's not a party. It's a coalition that comprises a very large spectrum of forces ranging from Christian Democrats to the Communist Party. This coalition was created in the early 70s, before dictatorship, and was able to reconstruct itself very quickly after democratization, and won the government for the first time, well, they were in parliament, but they won the first presidential election in 2004. Uruguay had a dictatorship like other countries in Latin America between 73 and 95, in 85. Feminists began organizing in the early 20th century, late 19th century, but this has blossomed with democratization as elsewhere in the region. No? Well, as mentioned before, there has been a moment in Uruguay where abortion was criminalized, was decriminalized. The 38th law that recriminalized abortion said that abortion was a crime, but also established that punish could be mitigated in the case of rape. Family honor is written like that in the code. Undue economic burden or in the case of life's risk. And as everybody knows, in October 2012, the president, José Mujica, very famous left-wing Uruguayan president, signed into law the Voluntary Interruption of Pregnancy Bill that made Uruguay the first country in South America to have legal abortion nationally, and the third country in the region, fourth country if you consider Cuba back there. The law permits abortion under certain circumstances in the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. In the case of rape, abortion is permitted until 14 weeks. There are no limits for a woman's life's risk or fetal abnormality. This is discussed with the doctors. The procedure is available in the public health system free of charge, but a woman must be a resident of the country for at least 1 year to access abortion legal services. Abortion continues, however, to be criminalized when performed outside of the parameters established by the law. Since 2012, around 28,000 women have resorted to the legal abortion services in Uruguay. Let's see how this happened, the saga. Abortion rights claims were raised by the feminist movement since the very early moment of democratization, within and outside political parties, with lots of discussions, like typical of the time. This is not a priority, our priority at the work is typical discussions, but they pushed for that. And later on in the 90s, under the impact of the UN conferences, Beijing, Cairo, where Uruguayan feminists had a very significant role internationally, these debates have really intensified. As soon as democracy was restored, the very first year, a member of the Colorado Party has proposed the first bill to legalize abortion. That did not reach the plenary, but at least it was there. In 1992, a member of Frente Amplio, now a left-wing parliamentarian, proposed another bill that went further ahead but didn't get the plenary either. The important element of this bill is that it proposed decriminalization. It's the only bill in the story of the reform that proposed decriminalization. A third tentative was tried in the late 90s. Didn't work either. Finally, in 2001-2002, Uruguay was affected, very badly affected, by the spillover of the Asian financial crisis, Uruguay and Argentina. Poverty levels increased, inequality increased, and in that context, it was detected a big rise in maternal mortality rates relating to abortion. And this was a scandal, because maternal mortality rates were very low in Uruguay. So there was an uproar, that both feminists and health professionals came out to say that this is a scandal, we need to do something. And two initiatives started then. The first, it was a political legal reform push. The proposal of a new law on sexual and reproductive health and rights. It was named like that. That began to be discussed in Parliament. And the second is that health professionals established a policy of harm reduction in relation to abortion, which was to say, okay, abortion is illegal, we cannot do nothing, but health professionals can support women who are going to abort by providing them with the necessary information, telling them to have antibiotics to return to the doctor after abortion to prevent the detrimental effects of clandestine and safe abortion. This began in the main hospital in Montevideo, the main maternity hospital, and then spread all over the national health system. From the political point of view of abortion, this moment is very critical because this was when a very solid link was established between abortion rights, health policies, and social justice. Huh? This created a climate that you don't find it in other places, in other contexts in the region. And the bill began to be processed in Congress, but in 2004 it was defeated in the Senate. Even when public opinion polls said that 60% of the Uruguayan population supported the bill. So far, senators just didn't vote it. That same year, there was a new presidential election, and for the first time, the Frente Amplio was elected. And the person who became the president is a doctor, an oncologist named Tabarez Vasquez, who had previously declared his position against abortion on a medical standard, classical medical standard that doctors have to take care of life, etc. Despite the views of the president, feminists in society and female senators, female deputies and partners pushed for another sexual and reproductive rights bill. They faced strong reactions at that point from the Catholic Church, where they are working very strongly, much more than before, through the Blancos, to the National Party, the Conservative Party. And the bill was fully approved by the Senate in October, November 2008. I had the privilege to be in Montevideo, and I have witnessed the voting. I was there for a seminar. We suspended the seminar to go to the Senate to see what is happening. It's an incredible memory of that voting. We are so happy. Yet, a week later, President Vasquez, against the position of the majority of his cabinet, just two ministers went with him, against the position of his own party, the Socialist Party, he sanctioned the bill but vetoed the abortion articles. It was a scandal. This was considered political, something that does not happen in Uruguay because it was a monarchic. The Uruguayan political process is very democratic, particularly on the left. It's a coalition, it's not a political party. His position was very badly viewed on all sectors. Huh? And the struggle for abortion restarted. Nothing could be done. Meanwhile, Vasquez was in power. But in 2009, there was a new election, and then President Mujica was elected. And the feminists in parliament and the feminists in society used this as an opportunity to push for a specific legislation on legal abortion. So they pushed it quickly. It was approved by the Senate. It arrived on the chamber of deputies in September 2012, and then the Frente Amplio realized that it had the majority, but it didn't have enough votes to approve the law as it was. Because one of its members, a Christian Democrat, said, "I'm not going to vote." At that point, another Christian Democrat from a very small independent party said, "I vote for the law whenever you change the context." So the only way to approve the law was to get hostage of this pending vote of Congressman Ivan Posada. What did Posada do? He weakened the rights language. He introduced language on the social value of motherhood and protection of life. Abortion, that was not addressed in the previous text as something bad, now is couched in terms of something, an evil that needs to be avoided, etc. Most importantly, a requirement of a clearance was introduced in the law, that the woman has to undergo a consultation with three professionals, including obligatory in OBGYN, a psychologist and a social worker, before she's granted the right to terminate a pregnancy. This can take between 5 days and 3 weeks, depending on the place you are in the country. And conscious objection that was in the text, the original text of the law, now is extended, not just to individuals, but to institutions. Okay? Well, let's go back a little bit in history. As this saga was going on, and I think it's important to say that, Uruguayan feminists has done a great job. They have organized, they have created coalitions, they have talked beyond Montevideo, they have used all sorts of strategies, seminars, debates, horizontal conversation. They have used body language in critical moments, like really going naked into the streets. But most principally, they have talked beyond the women's movement. And in particular, very important in Uruguay was the alliance they had made with the unions and the federation. The quoting there is Juan Castillo was the president of the National Federation of Workers when all this struggle was going on. And so they really managed to ground the abortion rights debate very deep in society. And they have also managed to construct arguments against abortion that went beyond the idea of individual women's rights to abort. Not just about individual women's decision. It's about social policy, it's about health policy, it's about sex education, or comprehensive sex education, and a question of democracy, a question of social justice. So they created a culture where all these ideas were circulating in society, no? And even if the law was not what feminists wanted, they immediately began making efforts to implement the law and also to prepare for attacks. And the attacks came very quickly. Right away, the conservatives came to call for a plebiscite, a referendum on the abortion law. Right away, 2 months later, quick. In Uruguay, the rule is that you cannot call for a referendum. There's a pre-referendum voting. The referendum just can be done if 25% of the voters say that we want the referendum. So the pre-referendum was set for June 2013, and the campaign done by pro-abortion rights advocates was so good that just 8% of the people came to vote. So the plebiscite was over. Well, everybody relaxed? No. Next step, the conservatives come and make a complaint to an administrative tribunal that deal with issues of public servants, requesting some definitions of the ministerial decree of implementation of the law to be changed to expand room for conscious objection. And the tribunal released this decision on August 2015. We are doing the case study. And in fact, the tribunal has granted those claims to the anti-abortion group. So now, a professional can request objection at any stage of the process. To begin with, the decree was that just the doctor at the end of the process, when he's prescribing the drug, could say no. And worse is that now doctors are not more obliged to refer the woman to another provider, which is very problematic. And in 2015, we discovered that attacks on abortion rights were coming through a back door because there's a commission discussing a full reform of the penal code. And there, the conservatives were getting infiltrating in order to get a new. This process is still going on the way. What were the results? Religious hospital, two religious hospitals that provide service to the public health system have requested institution conscious objection, so they're not providing the services. 30% of OBGYNs, one third in the country. There are just 600 OBGYNs in Uruguay. In one place, one department, Maldonado, 100% have requested conscious objection. So women there cannot have access to abortion, they have to go somewhere else. The study done by Misu says that not always this objection is really motivated for religious moral grounds. Many doctors are objecting simply because what the system pays for the consultation for him to prescribe an abortion pill is so small fee that they prefer not to do that job and do something else that pays more. And they are using that circuit. And for sure, services are much more affected outside Montevideo, where you have less services. No? Well, to finalize, as you have seen, given the situation of the region, the Uruguayan law reform is a breakthrough. And we have to still say that it's a breakthrough. We cannot entirely lambast what has happened there, because it has been a major breakthrough. But the limits of the law cannot be concealed either. What are the problems? It has preserved criminalization. A woman was arrested in 2015 because she performed an abortion outside of the law. The ironic part of it is that this woman is a poor sex worker. And Uruguay is one of the places in the world where sex work has not been criminalized for the last 100 years, where sex workers are recognized as, sex work is recognized as labor. So you have this horrendous conundrum of abortion law criminalizing a sex work because of abortion in a place where sex work is not criminalized. Worse yet, in Maldonado, exactly where there are no doctors, a woman died in February 2016 because she tried an abortion outside of the law in the second trimester. No? There's the problem of the clearance consultations. It makes difficult access to abortion, particularly in those places where you don't have so many professionals to cover all the cases. And people also say that in some small cities it creates moral constraints because everybody knows everybody. Something is for a woman to get to a consultation with one doctor and say, I need an abortion pill, and quickly go away. Something else is she getting back to the service, and it's a small city, and everybody will know that she's going to abort. And this is not always the best thing to happen. But some studies are also showing, which is the other side of the coin, that the professionals engaged, not so much the doctors, but the nurses, the psychologists, the social workers that are providing this support, they are doing their best not to coerce women. They are really being very supportive. And in some cases, the women prefer to take the pill with the support of the service. So it's sort of ambivalent. It's kind of, it needs to be looked with a more nuanced glance. However, the centrality of OBGYN is very problematic because it's just 600 in the country. If all of them decide that they're going to object, the law is gone, okay? You have to change the law, no way. And I would say that the exclusive access to medical abortion that has been established by the law through the public health system, although I can understand why they did so, they didn't want to create a wild market of access to the pills and have people coming from other countries to buy the abortion pills in Uruguay. I can understand the logic, but it may be one factor that is impairing access to safe abortion outside of the law, because then these women are using other methods or are using smuggled misoprostol that does not work properly. It's a problem. And the access of migrants, for sure, is a limitation. What are the lessons learned? Well, the Uruguayan case cannot be replicated. The conditions in Uruguay are so peculiar in so many senses that you cannot just, and this is very important to say, because there's this donor trend that you have a success story in one place and they want to transplant it everywhere. It's not transplantable. The conditions, historical conditions of Uruguay, the history of the feminist movement, the history of the left in Uruguay, I mean, it's so peculiar that it's not transportable. But there are lessons learned. First is that anti-abortion rights forces do not give up, and they are everywhere. Even in the best condition possible. Uruguay was the last contaminated place in the region, and they were there. Huh? Abortion rights politics is unending. Huh? It's an ending story. Law reform is never the end. It's just the beginning of a new cycle. Hmm? In regard to abortion, politicians, we don't know exactly why. Even left-wing politicians, secular politicians, even female secular left-wing politicians like my president, ex-president, hear more the arguments of anti-abortion forces than the arguments and the voices of society. We need to understand why this is so. In some cases, this is pure electoral calculations. It was not the case in Uruguay. Huh? Tabarés Vázquez didn't have any reason to hear more the Vatican than the Uruguayan society, but he did so. My late friend, José Barcelato, Chilean doctor, marvelous person who died a few years back, he used to say that in the case of Latin America, this is explained by the fact that a certain generation of politicians, all of them have been educated in Catholic schools. And this is imprinted forever and ever and ever. Huh? I think it's a good theory that needs to be checked. Huh? In any case, abortion legal reform requires tenacity, persistency, and rejuvenation of the movement. Because you see, it's 20 years. We are talking about a story of 30 years. Cannot be the same people. We need other people coming. In large coalitions linked with either social basis. It cannot be confined to the feminist movement. It's not going to go anywhere. And there's a question of timing and opportunity. In the case of Uruguay, it's very clear that the veto, the 2008 veto, was critical in terms of timing for the conservative forces because they had time to rebuild their strength. And this timing has compromised the content of the law in 2012. Huh? It's very big. They gain time. Huh? On the other hand, on the abortion rights crowd, people have been able to use very well the opportunity of the Mujica government. It was like either now or never. Huh? We have to do it right away and let's go for it the best way possible. Finally, and this is what we are trying to look into more in depth now, is that the Uruguayan case is very interesting sign to look into unresolved tensions between our regulatory models, structured around rights, autonomy, social justice, democracy, and a biomedical tutelary regime. That tries to resolve the problem of abortion bypassing the political problems of abortion politics. And in particular in Uruguay, this discussion is going on now, not just in regard to abortion, but also because the Ministry of Health just, because Tabaré Vázquez is again the president, and because he's an oncologist, and in this culture of where biomedicine has such a strength as a force, as a moral force in society, he imposed a new, it's not a law, it's a norm, it's a sanitary norm, of obligatory mammography for all women after a certain age. And there's a rebellion going on, okay? Women are rebelling against the rule. So I think that it's a very interesting place to look into those tensions, and this is sort of the challenge that we have before us for the next step. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Wow, fascinating. I'm reeling with the parallels and the richness of that narrative. But I'm not going to abuse my position as chair, and it's going to look around the room and seek comment or
Thank you so much. I couldn't stop thinking of Brazil, actually, using this. Because I did my PhD thesis on fertility decline in Brazil. And I mean, I was always
interested. A health facility?
Fertility. Fertility. Demographic background, so I did demography. So I looked at it from the perspective of the fertility decline and the, all the political movements and the, all the groups that, that were going on. And I mean, it always stands up, Brazil, as the country, Latin America, that was less affected by the Catholic influence in terms of. And also, I mean, there was this group kind of, in the literature I found, like the leftist Catholic groups that were allied with the feminist groups against the pronatalist government. So, I mean, I'm begging for the question, and I was begging at that time as well, why hasn't there been the same kind of push that there has been towards kind of promoting family planning, contraceptive use, kind of empowering women in the country, as much as there has been for abortion in Brazil?
Because it's over. That era is over. I can't talk about that. That's over. Forget it. This is a...
I can understand, but why in the past? There hasn't been, I mean, some kind of attempt, because, I mean, it seems to me that it's quite far, Brazil, from reaching even the same levels of Uruguay in terms of legislation and abortion as well.
No, we are on the verge of prohibited abortion in all grounds. We're going to become Nicaragua at this point in time. If you want, I can come next year and tell you about Virginia and traveling. We are on the verge of becoming like Nicaragua. I wrote a paper that I can send to you. I wrote it in 2010 during Dilma's election. And the title of the paper is Will Brazil Become Nicaragua? This is 6 years back, and we are on the verge of getting there. That story is over. And the PT administration, contrary to Uruguay, where you have just one person or two persons in the Frente Amplio who had played that strange game of alliance with the anti-abortion forces, in the case of the PT, it was much more disastrous. It was across the board.
I just don't understand why they never managed and they took the even the advantage during Lula. I mean, I can understand the regression in the last few years. Because obviously the politicians were much more...
Well, you have to remember that differently from Frente Amplio, which is really a left-wing coalition, or at least it has Christian Democrats, but the hegemony is left-wingers, either socialist or the Communist Party. Very important still today, and other left-wing forces. The origin of the PT is the Catholic Church. Do not forget that. The PT was never a communist stream of politics. It was almost anti-communist. It comes from the roots of the social work, the long history of the Catholic tradition of social commitments that goes back to Rerum Novarum in the 19th century and gained strength with theology of liberation, but the PT is a ramification of that work. That gathered people from the left as it expanded, but always hegemonized mostly by sectors that had that very strong Catholic origin. The secretary of Lula, personal secretary of Lula, Gilberto Carvalho, who became secretary of the presidency under Dilma. He's a person of the church that calls Rome and speaks to Rome in a direct light since ever. Not to mention the evangelicals in the political base of the Congress. I mean, Brazil is another case, okay? Brazil is really another case in point that requires a full, in fact, it can require a full seminar with many voices coming to explain what happened there, because it's hard to understand, even for us. But that, this is gone. First of all, because the theology of liberation has been destroyed by Jean Paul and Ratzinger, so it's not there anymore, long time. But there's also this distortion that what came out of the theology of liberation has been co-opted by lots of different things. PT politics on abortion is regrettable. Except for a very first moment between 2003 and 2005. Since then, it's down the road.
Worse
and worse.
So I have a question that's a bit related to Tiziana's. So I couldn't help but notice that there doesn't seem to be any correspondence between the new left and kind of more progressive approaches towards abortion and that. So I was wondering if you would say that there is any external characteristic that, I mean, Uruguay is kind of such an outlier in itself that it's difficult to generalize to other countries. But is there any external factor that would explain more, say, improvements in terms of abortion law? Like, so you mentioned income inequality. Now you're talking about the influence of Christianism, I guess. Or is it, I don't know, or you were also talking on the how established the feminist movements are in each country. So I don't know if there is anything to think that would kind of allow us to predict, you know, this country is going to probably make improvements because it shares this.
I think it's very hard to create simulations. Context matters a lot, but there are some elements that are very important. The existence of a strong feminist movement is certainly an element that is key for addressing the abortion problem in a manner that is not technocratic. Huh? Because you can, yes, indeed, resolve the problem of maternal mortality. You can reduce maternal mortality. Yes, through technology. You provide abortion pills everywhere, you're going to reduce maternal mortality. But to address the problem of abortion as a rights issue, as a question of democracy, as a question of autonomy, of integrity of the person, of the ability of somebody to decide about her life, you require a very strong feminist movement. Huh? There's no way out. I'm not saying that you should not do the democratic approach to resolve maternal mortality. I'm not saying that, forget about that. But from a political perspective, it is necessary to have a very strong feminist movement with the capacity to dialogue across different sectors in society, which is the success of the Uruguayan case. Huh? They have been able to reach out beyond their boundaries. In particular, I'm looking to Lindsay. One of the times, I have followed the process very closely because I have been going to Uruguay since the late 90s. And one of the seminars that I have been here was really with everybody from the religious communities that was not part of the compact that was against abortion. So there were the Jews, there were the Afro-Uruguayans, some sectors of the Protestant church, some people connected with the Kardecista spirituals. Everybody sitting in the room and talking about abortion. Hmm? We haven't seen that happen in any other country in the region, at least to my information. Usually, feminists in other countries have mainly relied on the left-wing parties, the alliance with the doctors and the lawyers, and have looked to the state. They have not done the ground level work of creating and transforming a perception of abortion in society itself. I think that's the key in the case of the Uruguayan experience.
I think we can draw parallels with the very heavy emphasis in sub-Saharan Africa of under, for example, the MDGs and now the SDGs. And such a huge focus on, you know, bringing down maternal mortality and if you like, dealing with unsafe abortion is a technocratic way of dealing with that. But it happens in a silo. It happens without the broader coalition around it. It becomes a very biomedical, very technocratic approach, which politically leaves things very, very exposed. I think you see parallels.
Which is the case of Colombia. Because it was a core decision, it was top down. Abortion services are very fragilized because there has not been enough ground level work. So it's not just conscious objections that some services are openly attacked by the evangelicals, so that going down and be able to construct bottom up and top down at the same time, I think it's the peculiar and the most important learning from the Uruguayan case that allows them to continue.
Okay. I can see how can and I'm always here.
This is fascinating. Don't know, of course, the, to this extent, extent the region. I can't, I mean, I followed your discussion, but it made me think about Turkey, of course, and it made me think essentially what you are saying is very important in the sense that for those countries where there are long established rights to abortion and how they are not ever stable,
mm-hmm.
and they're very dependent on context, and context in the sense of temporality of that context, how it changes over time. I mean, in Turkey, this has been, of course, a very well-established right, which are all sorts of other things. But in the last, I would say, 4 years, there are mechanisms created to control it in
yeah.
such a way that it's stopping a lot of services being available. It started with removing abortion as a possible clinical intervention from the accounting system, from the hospitals,
mm-hmm.
from the computerized system. So if doctors cannot assign it to a category, they cannot perform the process.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been going on. Now, this it was a mistake. And then they went on to change the law in terms of the timings, who can have access. It's moving in the very negative direction. Now, but of course, we are not Catholic or
no.
In Christian terms. But there's the religious aspect of this on the one hand. But then the question is why we don't hear many people actually come out and challenge this. My explanation, in a way, probably in line with what you are saying, is that we need to think what this right to abortion signify for the rest of society. If it's not a medical issue, sort of medicalized, okay, for health we have to do it sort of thing, but it's a rights claim, freedom claim. Freedom, claim to decide yourself. It's a major challenge to patriarchy in society and a woman's position. And that sort of, in a way, is creating these very unsavory alliances of silence around
mm-hmm.
us. And I entirely agree, in some ways, what's also showing me that I can't say Turkey has ever had a very strong feminist movement, but whatever it had, was not able to create alliances to maintain that right which was gained long time ago. I mean, it's really going down the drain at the moment, broadly. And very few people take it as a cross-political issue, a women's
mm-hmm.
rights issue. It's just shocking to see.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of private discourse and public distancing.
Yeah.
Something we see a lot of.
Yeah.
You know, we work in Zambia, and had a Termination of Pregnancy Act since 1972.
Yes.
Earlier this year, referendum to put in a constitution that might begin with conception. The only reason it didn't pass, they didn't reach a quorum on the number of people voting.
Yeah.
These stories are being
repeated.
I have a hand here, lady, and yeah, lots of questions. Thank you.
Well, in Chile, we have feminist organization that movement that has been getting stronger in the last years, and we have a lot of problems to tackle. And this year, well, as you said, there was this bill being discussed in parliament, but we also have this other reform for the domestic violence, which is going to be like a general law against violence against women, and there has been like a trade-off between both laws,
mm-hmm.
and the feminist movement is like just like being fooled in a way to be happy with this law against violence, and the law against abortion. It's being like invisibilized, and well, I have some friends inside the government, and they have told me that don't wait for it because it's not going to happen. Like they are
mm-hmm.
doing this whole charade of like we are working on abortion, but we are actually not doing it, and we are focused on violence. So I wanted to ask you if you know another places in Latin America where this had happened?
All over.
Okay.
The big consensus on gender violence
in gender violence is seen in a very limited way because it's usually domestic violence.
Yeah.
It's not properly addressing sexual violence at worst. It's all being framed in terms of criminal response. Okay? So this is everywhere. Okay? And here we have a huge problem, which is the problem of the paradox of criminal law. On the one hand, we are requesting that criminal laws are suspended in the case of abortion, and at the same time, we are pulling waters of criminal justice by calling for criminal responses to gender-based violence. It's a huge conundrum that needs to be named and discussed. Huh? And the worst part of it, this is all over the place. I mean, feminicide, gender-based violence has become the feminist legal reform agenda of the world today, without any serious interrogation. First of all, if the laws that have been adopted and implemented are having any effect. Indicators show that not. Brazil has approved the law, a criminal law, 10 years back. The reduction in homicides is almost nil. 1%. In compensation, you have indicted and probably put to prison lots of men that are certainly poor men because the rich ones can get rid of. We are adding to incarceration. So I'm just putting a small thread there. And so there's a question that we need to address up front. And the worst part is that in places like Brazil, where with the growth of really conservative fascist forces and dogmatic religious forces, anything that is about criminalization has the support of everybody. It's an incredible consensus. The law of feminicide that Dilma pushed right before being evicted, getting this year, was supported by her worst enemy in Congress, Eduardo Cunha, because all these guys are in favor of criminalization. So there's a question here that is, so feminists should be really very careful. This is everywhere. I mean, it's happening everywhere without people having a solid conversation about it. It's very distressing. I get very distressed.
Yeah, I think so. What was the point to yesterday? Thank you.
I was hoping if you could shed a bit of light on why do you think the 2008 Me Too movement, I mean, given the strong feminist movement and given the demand apparently from the grassroots level up, and then the Senate also approves it. So then, why do you think the Me Too actually happened? Was it because of, you know, what were the social relations or what actual forces came into it?
He himself, because of his connections with the Vatican through his son, who is a priest, sitting in Rome. It was totally autocratic. And this is his wife, he is not a religious person. Huh? He's a Francmason. But he's married to a very Catholic woman, known to be very Catholic, very conservative family in Uruguay, who has grown the children in the Catholic tradition. And they have this son who is a priest in Rome, in a very high level position in Rome. And this is not just about Tavares, it's also about how the Vatican operates, which through those channels of directly connecting with high level elites everywhere and having very private and directed conversations that it seems absurd, but this derives into political effects. There's a fascinating story that we tell in our 2008 book about how William Casey, that was the head of CIA under Reagan, sat in Rome, because he was a Catholic, with John Paul II. And the two of them devised an incredible geopolitical strategy around amplifying conservative Catholicism in Poland and crashing progressive Catholicism in Nicaragua, just because the two of them were friends and were in a position of power to do so. So, as classical political science this may seem, it's a dimension that we should not take out of our analysis. Because in this particular case, because I know many people in Uruguay, people that, I have a friend who is a doctor. She was the same generation of Tabata Vasquez in medical school. So they are friends since they are young people. And it was exactly that. He was entirely hooked by, which is very impressive, because the guy is a socialist, the guy has a resistant dictatorship, is an enigma. Huh? There's an enigmatic something there that explains how this person, at the end of the day, would comply with the Vatican order instead of following. You know, it was, he had to leave the Socialist Party in Uruguay. He now is independent. He's a president of the country independent because he broke his ties with the Socialist Party because of abortion. It's amazing. Huh? It's an amazing case. Huh? And I don't think he's the only one. Huh? I think we could look around for many leaders on that topic and do very specific case studies to understand why this is so. For me, it's fascinating.
Yeah, fascinating, but requires, constant vigilance. And I was very struck by how you talked about the timing of legal change in some settings post you call it revolutionary change. So there's debate at the moment, for example, that South Africa, which liberalised its laws in 1986 post the 1994 ANC victory, very, very real concern that that change only happened at that point in time. It was only possible at that point in time. And given the high funded activities of the particularly US-based Christian evangelical movement in Sub-Saharan Africa at the moment, we've seen them lobbying and leaves. Again, constant vigilance, because laws change and laws are regressed. Sorry, you've been sitting very patiently.
No, no, I know nothing about the subject, as you know, I'm quite interested in your point about the kind of machinations of power. So we've seen this, you've sort of expressed a macro picture of history in a nice chronological order, with the governments, the medical profession, social sectors coming together. But then we've also just touched on a person or a prime minister who has, as an individual, on a microcosmic level, made such a huge impact. So, I mean, that's just affecting my question a little bit, or my comment, which is, I'm quite interested in the two things that you said. Firstly, about the access to birth control, because that's an enormous parallel to the access to abortions, obviously. Also, you mentioned this idea that the family honour, an abortion was permissible. And I'm wondering who makes the decision in that, on the ground. Who is the decision maker as to whether or not this pregnancy has serious effect on family? I'm just wondering if it's the males. I want to know how that, again, the machinations of power works on the ground, especially given that prostitution is legalized. I'm really fascinated by which the very presence of all of those laws for an individual woman, how those work together.
Yeah, I think that is really the microphysics of this is really very fascinating. Concerning contraception, levels of contraception have escalated in the region. What I said about fertility decline is that because, with variations across country, but you can say that in countries where access to contraception is very low, Bolivia, probably Guatemala, it's never less than 60% now. So it's really like this absence of consistent policies, through market outlets, where women for a long time have really moved into something that they don't want so many children, and they find their ways, and abortion is just one method that they make resource to. When I began my career in this domain a long time back, the Catholic Church also attacked contraceptives in the 70s and the 80s. From the 90s on, they have given up that, okay, because the reality, the very concrete reality of how this was going, they just said, we cannot cope with that. The forces of market, of women in the labor market, of education, of the change in family structure, there's nothing we can do about it. So they have given. In Brazil, they tried a little bit until the mid-90s, and then and concentrated on abortion. So abortion became the procreative problem for them. The rest is negotiable. We don't need to do the da-da. So there's no restrictions. For example, Uruguay is a very interesting place because when, again, we began this journey, there was though the story that Uruguay had already very low fertility control, and the conservatives were against contraception there, not just the Catholics, because you need a bigger population. It was a country there was a pro-natalist policy, but this disappeared. So now contraceptive is everywhere. It's not everywhere as it should be, but it's not a moral problem anymore. And then it's abortion. Everywhere become. The second thing is about honor. That notion of honor is in the code of 1938 that has been reformed. It's not now anymore. Okay? All abortion reforms of the 30s in Latin America, by and large, have allowed for abortion in the case of rape. It was a kind of regional trend. I think the lawyers and jurists were talking with each other. But it was never rape because of the rape itself. It was because a child that would be born from a rape would disturb and disrupt the patriarchal order of the family, including in terms of inheritance and etc. So all those codes are framed in terms of the honor of the family, or the honor of the woman. But then it was the feminists later on, we in the 70s, that pick up those articles in the code and say, no, this is about sexual dignity. It's about bodily integrity of women. We reinterpret the law, but in the origin, those laws are entirely patriarchal. It's not about women's sexuality.